The following shiur is being recorded for TorahDownloads.com, a project of the Yehuda Mann Foundation, Le'ilui Nishmas Yehuda Aryeh ben Yoshua Yakir.
They tell over a story from the Brisker Rav, I guess not a story, but as much as an expression of his, that he once saw somebody with a very long beard. And the Rav described it was long and long and long, and finally at the end, there's a little piece after that also. I guess we had said last week we would conclude the Emunah things. There are two pieces of beard I wanted to add to that. One is an article I came across this Thursday in the New York Times, and I really thought that it's an extraordinary article, and I wanted to share it because it brings home so many of the points he made. And the second thing was a little more about the trust in Torah Sheval Peh and so on, which I felt we hadn't done yet quite. We had explained what Torah Sheval Peh was, but so to speak, confirming the validity of what we have and so on, I wanted to add that also. Okay. The article is in the New York Times on Thursday, August 6, 2009. It is called Spleen. And finally, the spleen gets some respect by Natalie Angier. Now, this article is was printed originally, it's based on an article in Science, which is, the journal Science is the premier scientific journal in America. Anything of value published there, this is the premier article, journal. It is the showcase. And this was written by researchers from Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. As good as you can get. Now, yes. Yeah. The article is going to basically, it's built on the following point. The spleen is an organ in the body. For those you're not familiar, it's a kind of spongy-like material full of blood vessels. It doesn't really seem to have all that much to do. And the only thing it does do is it causes trouble. If God forbid, if somebody has an accident and the spleen gets ruptured, it bleeds profusely. You can bleed to death from a ruptured spleen. And what they do to emergency surgery, they operate and remove it, and you feel as good as you ever did. Maybe like a half a pound lighter. But other than that, there's nothing, no bad side effect. Which led intelligent people to conclude that it is a completely extra organ. Really, really might have had some sort of function at some point in the past, but Bismana Zet's no longer, so why is it here? It's a vestige, and this is one of the few organs, one of the few pieces in the body that that seem to point towards evolution. It's extra, it has no use. God wouldn't have dumped it in an extra organ. It obviously was once upon a time needed. It wasn't a bad enough organ so that it got weeded out for evolution, and that's what it stayed. That's the premise, it's one of the proofs. There are two or three others, the appendix, the other obvious one, and then there's a bottom bone in the spine, which is a zecher of a tail, and that is also kind of unnecessary. How do you prove something's unnecessary? It's very simple. Or cut open, take out. Nobody's ever died when they take out his appendix. People have died, but not because the appendix was taken out. Same with the spleen. No one's ever died. People live very happily ever after, so on and so forth. That is the premise, and it's always been kind of a proof for it. In this report, it says they all of a sudden discovered that the spleen is a reservoir for huge numbers of immune cells called monocytes. And in the event of a serious trauma to the body, like a heart attack, gashing wound, or microbial invasion, the spleen will disgorge those monocytes into the bloodstream to tackle the crisis. And Dr. Narendorf, a researcher from Harvard Medical School, says it's like a reserve army in a society. You don't want to have, you can't have an army on the battlefield strength army all the time. So you have a reserve army where you can call it up whenever you need it. That's what it is. Researchers are only now discovering a major feature of a rather large organ they've been studying for at least 2,000 years demonstrates yet again that there's nothing so foreign as the place you call home. Dr. Narendorf said, the more you learn, the more you realize that we're just scratching on the surface of life. We don't know the whole story about anything. He then said they always thought that these cells came from the bone marrow, these monocytes, and now they realize that it comes from the spleen, and that they have to reevaluate the entire understanding of how the immune reaction works. The latest work also sounds a cautionary note against underestimating a body part or dismissing it as vestigial, expendable, or past its prime. In other words, we don't dismiss something as being a vestige because you don't know what it is. Let's see if there's anything else. There's another quote. Researchers cite other cases in which organs were presumed to be so dispensable that they could be removed prophylactically, meaning there are other organs that they don't really contribute much to the body, we don't think they contribute anything, and therefore just take them out. When I was growing up, tonsils were considered to be just extras, and as soon as you had a cold, myself included, tonsils came out, no problems. I was 6 years old, I had colds and had a tonsil operation. It was considered almost like a bris mila. You went through it, always. Then he gives another example. In recent years, for example, many women undergoing hysterectomies, which means you remove the uterus, have been advised to have their healthy ovaries also removed, because what's the point of it? It's an extra organ. Yet follow-up surveys have shown that women underwent elective ovariectomy had a heightened risk of dying during a given study period, were more susceptible to heart disease and lung cancer, and were twice as likely to develop Parkinson's disease compared with women who had kept the ovaries. So there's a very, very interesting point here. A, we know very little. One has to be very careful from making any type of claims about vestiges. And this, we take this back to a very central point in the reasoning. Lo ra'inu eino raya. When science says we have not discovered any role for the appendix, that statement is not a definite statement. All it says is they have not discovered. You can't turn that statement logically into saying, and therefore it has no role. And we do it time and again. We say, well, the best scientists have been studying this for dozens of years and have not found anything. We take out the appendix from people and they live happily ever after. Well, guess what? They did the same with the spleen. They did the same with the ovary. The ovary makes even less sense. An ovary has a very specific role. And yes, a woman cannot have babies if she doesn't have an ovary. But what other than that? And all of a sudden you discover things are a lot more complex about it. This is 2009, and it's just another example that when science discovers a thing, a fact, that's provable, repeatable, it's a fact. We have to live with it and see it as such. But when scientists make an evaluation, it's an evaluation. And much of what's not known, like he says here, we're talking about the top research, we're not talking about crackpots, we're not talking about from people, we're talking about real scientists. And they say that we've just scratched the surface in understanding the complexity of the organs. There's one more sentence here that really, really is interesting. A thing like this leaves a person to heighten the emunah. And this is no exception. Dr. Narendorf says, evolution has an edge on us. I would be very careful about saying you don't need this organ, get rid of it. So the name of the god is evolution, who's planned the body so carefully that chas v'shalom, one should possibly say that there is anything extra. Evolution works so perfectly that it doesn't leave any vestiges. So the logic works well on both sides. If one finds vestiges, it's a clear proof of evolution. Evolution is not perfect. It's a process. You know, a natural process has its little glitches. And when we find the perfection of the human body, it helps us give an added reverence for evolution, seeing about how perfect evolution is. That's an article I really felt I wanted to share with everybody. By the way, the statistics were that for people who had heart attacks, the people without a spleen were, I believe, twice as likely to die from a heart attack as people without it. I don't have this somewhere within it, but what they do is they come in very quickly, these cells, and fix it up, take away the dead cells, etc., etc. Okay, that's one thing I just wanted to share. I felt it was something I'd seen. It made a tremendous impression on me, and it's just good to know, because logically this was waiting in the wings. When you say a statement, I have not found, the word that needs to be added is yet. We have no idea, impossibility from not finding people who are familiar with math. Know that in math, where reasoning has to be very rigid, people have done certain calculations time and again, and they've found that you cannot get a whole number to fit this, you cannot get that, but that never counts as proof for impossibility. A proof of impossibility means a definitive proof that it cannot be, but we have not found any number to fit this. We have not found tons and tons of riddles in math. We had intuitive feeling about it, and we knew that it should be like that, but it waited for definitive proof. So I just felt this article was much alarming. That's one point I wanted to bring out. A second point was about Torah Sheba'al Peh that I felt needed to be rounded out. It's a point confirming sort of the solidity of Torah Sheba'al Peh. Let's start with a derision of Torah Sheba'al Peh. Yes, we have an oral law. Have you ever played a game of telephone? And a teacher in a classroom gets up, and he tells, and he has everybody whispering something to everybody else. So he starts with the first student in the class, and then he whispers something in his ear, and then the last student, the 45th, everybody whispers the first to the second to the third to the fourth, and finally the 50th one announces in front of the class what he heard from the 49th guy. Inevitably, it is very, very funny. You start with apple, you end with elephants dancing on the moon. It's a very, very funny thing. And then the dramatic says, well, this is happening in 5 minutes with 50 people. Imagine if you're transmitting this 3,000 years ago into what you're saying, and you're talking about hundreds of people in transmission, or whatever it is, minimal 150, 170, I think, works out to. So how accurate do you think you got? That has been sort of a derision about Torah Sheba'al Peh and so on. First of all, let's just debunk the whole that whole little show. It's like every little show. It's very cute, but it has nothing to do with the reality. He's talking about people whispering to each other, things that they perceive to be nonsense, and that's it. We're talking about people sitting their entire lives being Osek in Torah, debating it with hundreds of other people, again and again and again and again, cross-firing, proving, debating, and so on and so forth. We do not claim in Torah Sheba'al Peh necessarily that the words stayed the same as Torah Sheba'al Peh, but that the content and the ruach stayed the same, that we do claim. And we will try to confirm it. But the thing that's very important to remember is it has nothing to do with a stupid game like that. If you walk in, you're not talking about people whispering in each other's ears, you're talking about a whole bunch of people arguing a point. You're talking about a constant reference back to a Torah Sheba'al Peh. You're talking about a dead serious enterprise as opposed to some stupid parlor game with a bunch of high school kids, and so on. Somebody once told over, and I'll take his word for it, he did the same experiment at an NCSY convention and got the same rubbish as, you know, at the answer. He then changed the rules a bit. And he had four lines of 20 people, and he took out $100 bills or $400 bills, promised each group that got it right $5 to each person. And three of the four groups got it perfectly right, and the fourth group got it nearly right. And again, you're talking about a bunch of kids on a vacation, and $5 made all the difference between if they were horsing around or they paid a lot of attention. So bear that in mind as far as that. But let's take a different thing. A person walks into a Yemenite synagogue and looks around, and he observes it. And then he walks into a Chassidish shtibel in Poland. Before, you know, then he walks into a German shul, and he sits there and observes that. He then goes to America and looks at a modern Orthodox synagogue. He then goes to a Sephardi place in Morocco. If he was an anthropologist, he would conclude that you're talking about five very different religions with some common background. But everything is extremely different. The tone of music, the dress, the decor of the synagogue. The Yemenites are sitting on the floor, the Hasidim are running all over the place, the Germans are sitting like mummies in their wooden pews. Modern Orthodox synagogue has an auditorium feel, and the type of music and so on is very different. And these are five very different religions. If anything, an intelligent anthropologist would say, the German synagogue has more in common with a cathedral in Germany than it does with the shul in Yemen. And the Yemenite shul, with tone and the music and all that, has more in common possibly with the mosque over there than it has with the Chassidish shtibel. Chassidish shtibel is talking about what it has in common with. We cannot really find another religion to make it, identified with. But and even Chassidim itself, one would go to a Litvish Chassidus such as Lubavitch, or and see people kind of very very stiff. And you go to a place where, like Karlin, which is also actually a Litvish Chassidus, and people are screaming and yelling. And once again, you conclude the differences are radical. A person would. And so on. In what they serve Friday night would be very different in each place. The foods they eat and so on. Now let's put on our halachic glasses, and let us make a list of what's important, what's not important. So somebody asked me what tefillah is. Okay, tefillah is Shmoneh Esra, preceded by Kriyat Shema uBerachoseha, of which one bracha deals with Yotzeror, with Oros. One bracha deals with Torah, one bracha deals with Yetzias Mitzrayim. Those are the foundations of the Rabban Haru Metakne. The halachos of Shabbos is you're supposed to eat warm food, you're not supposed to heat it up, you're not supposed to cook it on Shabbos, etc. And a person was to walk into those shuls and he would say halachically, they are identical. It doesn't say anyway what type of tune. And the Mela, it ran off in its own direction. Doesn't say anywhere what type of Levush. There's a longer Levush, it says covered, it says Yocha if not. But other than that, whatever you want, you can wear. Doesn't say anything about the core and how to sit and so on. It says to sit very respectfully, but other than that, there's nothing about it. But it does say Shmoneser. Everybody's got Shmoneser with 18 brachas and a 19th bracha. Everyone's, all the shinin ischos and tefillah are absolutely meaningless in halacha. The Chaznish said there are only two differences in ischos and sfarad, meaning in halacha, and the whether you finish in Makadosh Shema Yisrael, Makadosh Shmoy Berabim in La'olam Yodam, whether you finish with a bracha or not. The Rizal said not. We say yes. That's a halachic difference. And one other thing, I don't remember what. But there is no difference. Not one community in the world ever, and we're talking about communities that have been cut off for centuries. Yemen was cut off for centuries and centuries, maybe millennium. A lulav and an esrog are very clearly, no one ever debated what an esrog is. The Torah doesn't say what an esrog is. The Torah says a beautiful fruit. Nobody brought a mango in. Nobody brought in a passion fruit. Everyone brings in an esrog is an esrog. An esrog come in different forms, but they're esrogim. And lulavim are lulavim, and hadasim are hadasim, and arabis are arabis, all across. Shechita is the same shechita we have. There are all sorts of little things that people kill each other for. Yes, should you use a knife that's been sanded down, or not sanded down, whatever the big machloks in chassidim, we don't know today even what is geschliffene metzes, whatever that, there was a big fight about it. But in halacha, that has no real ramifications. It has ramifications of it's better, it's this, it's that. Mikveh, what does a mikveh look like? Across the board, on the first three tiers of nafgimin in halacha, it's exactly the same. The differences are all minor points about a minor point. No real fundamental machlokas in observance. No one in the Gemara, you don't find the alternative shittas that the Gemara doesn't pass on, like adapted anywhere or taken anywhere. So we've been able to keep a Torah Shabbal Peh intact for what is 2,000 years. We have communities like Tayman, which definitely go back 2,000 years, they claim even more, I don't know. And yes, there's been some cross-fertilization, but no one's ever recorded examples of very different hanhagas that are Mikra Din. You have travelers like Binyamin Toledo and others who traveled and they recorded everything interesting they found, and all those interesting things are all minhagim. Where they are recorded was kept as a special room, and you have to walk in one place, walk out another place. And people would eat Friday night a big meal before they went to shul, then they come back from shul, just make kiddush and go to and eat something small, go to sleep. You know, those are a riot of all sorts of interesting minhagim, but nothing of any real halachic difference. So we've been able to keep, and don't forget, we're talking about communities that were isolated. I mean, today there's nothing isolated anymore, but 100 years ago, to writing a letter someplace took weeks, and sometimes it got there, sometimes it didn't get there. And we're talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago when there was no communication whatsoever, and it kept. So we were able to keep it for 2,000 years. Doesn't that say something about our consistency and how strong we kept it? Josephus is before the Churban. He's a non-rabbinic source. He explains the quotes extensively about Jews and halachos minhagim. There are mistakes in it, which, taking into account that Josephus was a kind of, for a better word, we'll call him a Hellenized Jew, even though he claimed he was from the Prussian, but he definitely was very Roman and not connected to mainstream. Certainly was not a Talmud Chacham or any such tradition. But the Medrashim and the Chazals and the Halachis are all what we're familiar with. He makes mistakes. Yes, there's a list of a dozen mistakes that's clear that he was no Talmud Chacham. But the mistakes are not way out. They're whether Tamei or Tahor, you know. But the points are the same. So if we've been able to keep it for 2,200 years under circumstances that were very, very difficult, it shows it can be done well. Even if you look at Sfarim, no one in a Beis Medrash has trouble picking up a sefer from any corner of the earth, from any time period, and feel that this is strange, different, or just not shayach. You pick up a tshuva sefer written anywhere, anytime. It's part of it. It integrates seamlessly in a tshuva sarashba written in Spain, a tshuva written in Yemen. Babylonian things, all of it is to us very, very much the same. It falls along common shittas in Rishonim. Not much of all the sforms we've ever been able to uncover, we have not uncovered anything that is different. There are machlokas and shittas within what one would consider normative halacha. And this is, even taking into account, there is a wariness about touching Rishonim that we don't know who they are, because there may have been an Amoritz who just had money and could sit and write. But there hasn't been found anything that's different in spirit that we don't feel comfortable with. So if we know that for 2,000 years we did keep it intact under the most difficult conditions, you have to write everything by hand and so on and so forth, there's no reason to think that the 1,000 years before that was any different. That is one of the most powerful proofs there are. So people come along and say, well, what about the Karaite Mesoris? Don't they have a different Mesoris where they're against Torah Shabbat and so on? And the answer to that is very simple. We also have reform. We're not talking about somebody gets up and makes a conscious decision to change, to cut what was, and start anew. Reform was a decision. It wasn't somebody had a Mesoris that was different, and said, why Mesoros is Yom Mesoros? People got up and said, we think the whole thing is junk, wrong, let's discard it. Yeah, that you had all the time. The same thing was true about the Karaites. The Karaites were not a Mesoros. The Karaites was started by somebody very specific. They claim who started it. He got up and said, Rabbi Isai, there's no such thing as Torah Shabbat Peh. Everybody should go and do and interpret the Torah as they see fit. So first of all, he has no historical tradition to go back on. It's his decision. It's compounded by the fact that there was a political reason for that decision. He was passed over. His father was the Gaon. They passed him over for younger brother. He was a little bit upset, and that's why he dumped it. So historically, there is no alternative. The Stukim did not have alternative beliefs. They discarded beliefs, and it was very clear that it was coming from the Stukim were Hellenized people, and once again, it was very clear that the rejection of Torah Shebaal Peh was coming not out of an inner conviction of not wanting Torah Shebaal, of saying internally this is wrong, but rather they were kind of what we'd say modern worldly people, did not like to be encumbered with a lot of halachas and so on, and discarded it. So yes, in history you've had tons and tons of people discarding halacha, that and Mesoros, that happens. But there is no alternative Mesoros. People also, so in my mind, this is one of the most powerful points that there is about the integrity of Torah Shebaal Peh, that it's been kept always, all the time, so on and so forth. The people come along, and I've heard this point again and again, well, why is there so much argument? All the rabbis disagree, and that's what makes Torah so unappetizing. And people don't like it because one rabbi says you can eat potato chips on Pesach, one rabbi says you can't, and one rabbi says maybe you can, and one rabbi says this, and all the rabbis can't agree. And that fragmentation is a tremendous degradation of Torah. Why can't all the rabbis get together and agree on something, so on and so forth? That Taina, it was actually Ben-Gurion, tried to organize a Sanhedrin. And the Gedol Yisrael, almost across the board, vehemently were against it. Besides the obvious reason that it's presumptuous to think we have 120 people today that would count as Dayanim and so on and so forth. The one good thing that remained from the whole thing was one of the sharpest remarks. There was a person named Rabbi Maimon, Fishman, Rabbi Fishman Maimon, who was a very, very avid fan of it. He wanted it. He was a very Mizrahi type of person. I think it was sort of part of the vision of Geula. And someone asked him, Rabbi Maimon, okay, let's say we can get Talmid Chachamim today that would fit for Sanhedrin. And let's say we can get Yerei Shemayim, but it's a Soni Betza. Where are we ever going to find Soni Betza today? And he answered, if you pay enough money, you can get Soni Betza also. That was one of the good lines that came out of the whole thing, but nothing more. But when they asked the Gedolim, I don't remember, it was a Chasnish, they asked him, why is he against it, and he says, I'd like to try to understand, he says, is Ben-Gurion really interested in getting a Sanhedrin together to give Skila B'zman Hazeh, or to get rid of a lot of mitzvahs? I mean, is it really the restoration of Torah, and we start giving people Skila for Chil Shabbos? Is that like what he's interested in? Or is he interested in, because the only way we have of undoing Takanis is through Sanhedrin. But at any rate, the point was always been, I've been asked this time and again, there would be people like Nesha Torah and their parents would come and they would say, you know, this is one thing that keeps not keeping the Torah. I mean, the reply used to be, okay, so how about starting by keeping all the mitzvahs that all the rabbis agree upon? That was always the counterpoint. But let's forget about that. That's cutesy and it's very nice. But I want to go to a different point. In a certain sense, the tremendous diversity and sometimes the vehement arguments. If you look at some of the Teshuvah Sfarim, the accusations that fly back and forth are horrific. I would refer you to the Malbach and the Marie Beirav when they argue about the Smicha. I mean, your ears singe just looking at the invective, very, very, very vehement arguments. It was actually about making Sanhedrin and Smicha. But there's a flip side to it. But all of those people arguing so vehemently agreed to the fundamental principles. The arguments were always how to project it, how to extrapolate it to a later point, how to understand that what it says. No one ever came along and says this whole section is not. The argumentative nature of the Rabbanan in the Gemara, in the Talmud, and of all of the Mefarshim afterwards, being that we don't have a Sanhedrin, in a certain sense assures the integrity of Torah. It tells us, well, dal mehachi, all of those arguments. Let's remove, but there's a core that no one argued with. And these were people that were very argumentative and were ready to pounce at any point that they felt was wrong. And there was never any argument about the basics, nothing. It was always about extrapolating it. Occasionally there'd be a question of how to paskin the Gemara. What is the Gemara's conclusion? Which sugi do we favor? Which sugi? And the Gemara doesn't have a clear psak. But no one ever contested the right for the Gemara to paskin. That once the Gemara did pass, there's no going back on it. No one ever contested the basic rules. There would be a question if you have a steering into rules, how to build up an argument, but never ever any argument about anything else. So if you have all of these people not agreeing in unison, if this would be like a very docile choir group kind of, everybody says, yes, amen, bless the Lord, and so on, then we'd say, okay, you know, they're zombies. Every person held his own really, really strongly and argued every last point vehemently. And yet, there's a tremendous corpus of material that everybody agrees upon. It does confirm very strongly for us the integrity of Torah. A, because of just the fact that we have all this evidence on, and B, if anybody were to come along and try to pass off a new Torah, he would get tremendous arguments. That's another line of defense for the integrity of Torah. Historians go back and they always blame the Frum community for being kanoi. For instance, let's just take the Ramchal. The Ramchal, we know, is a great person. Anyone who knows a little bit of history knows that he was excommunicated, driven from his country, had his farm burned, banned, etc., etc. And historians write about mean-spirited and da da da. But, one second, any time somebody tried to bring in something that was new, the burden of proof, big time, was on him. Chassidus met with a tremendous isnagdus because it was different, it was new. And you had to answer those arguments in the eyes of the public, in the eyes of Rabbanim, and so on. Kabbalah, people involved in Kabbalah were, in many places, they were against them. And I tell people the reason why the Arizal is so accepted is because of the fact that the Arizal lived in one of the great centers of Yiddishkeit in a very, very in a tkufa when you had Kol Gdol Yisrael living in Tzfas. He was a young man. He got up and said a new Torah, another dimension of Torah. Now, then it didn't change halachas, but the new dimension of Torah coming straight from Eliyahu. And nobody, and everybody sat in rapt attention and said, you know, he's emes and his Torah is emes. That's the only reason we'd ever accept that result, or else we would take his farm and put him in Geniza. The Ramchal did not have that stature, and that's why a lot of his farm were put in Geniza. And even today, when we use Ramchal's farm so much, there are farm that we say, we don't know. We draw a line and say, we don't know how to digest his farm. He was a great man, but this farm are not for circulation. The Rizal had the Besos, the Shulchan Aruch sat at his feet in the anonym of Kabbalah as an Evid Kamemari. The Ramak, Ramesha Kordavero, who was the doyen of Kabbalah till his time, the Ramak was the great Mekobel who summed up the Kabbalah Rishonim, was older than the Rizal, and was being surpassed. The Rizal's Kabbalah was going a whole new step further, and the Ramak bowed his head to him, acknowledged him. That's the only reason why we accept the Rizal for what he is. The peer review was very powerful, and anything that was not unanimously accepted, we take with caution. One of the reasons why, I don't want to go into politics, I don't want to go into specifics, but one of the reasons why Breslev is treated with such suspicion is not the Mesnagdim were against Breslev, the Chassidim themselves, his contemporary rebbes, almost all were very vehemently opposed to it. Not even clear why, because they were so vehement, they didn't want to discuss it, but he had vehement opposition from his real peers. So it leaves you to a big question mark. Yes, maybe it was so much bigger, they didn't understand him, it's possible. But on the other hand, we don't have the certainty of that askama. We're very, very wary of taking on any new Torah. It rightfully engenders opposition. Torah is the transmission of what we have, the development of what we have. Even Reb Chaim Brisker, who we accept today as being Torah, as the Kenya from Sinai, had Misnagdim. If you'll take a look, the Ritvaz, who was a brilliant contemporary of his, called Reb Chaim Brisker an alchemist. He said he's not taking gold and fashioning into a necklace. He's dropping a piece of lead into a vat, and presto, he tells us gold appears. I'm wary of people who pull out gold from, like, hey, where are you coming from? It's very different than the Shita we had before. It's very different than the Derech we had before. And it's suspect. And it is to Reb Chaim's credit that not only was it a really new development in Torah, within Torah, but it was accepted by so many who weren't that Shita and Derech Dafka. His contemporaries didn't. Reb Chaim was highly, highly original, and yet everyone felt that this is an emes within Torah. His peer review is what allows us to take it comfortably and say it might look different, but the people understood the nuances of what was, and him said this is just the next step in what's laying inside the old Torah already. So the natural hisnagdus of Kaiser. And that's why when people have problems that the Rabbanim react rather than being proactive, they always seem to be two steps behind, etc., 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 and a lot of issues. There are two, and there may be some we would discuss in some later things, but just for our sake, the Torah can never be innovative. You can't graft a new branch on it. You can re-examine and find something within it. For instance, Reb Shamshon of Fall Hirsch, even though also it was very different, the style, the approach, everything than before, was held in extremely high regard by his Hungarian and Polish contemporaries, because even though he spoke a new language, there was a sense it's another translation of the Ayin Lashonos of Torah. It was not the same with all the other Reform and other people, where the feeling was this is a grafting of a new thing into the tree of Torah, and the tree rejects the grafts. It's a close call. Very hard to tell sometimes whether a new branch growing out, somebody grafted it in, or it's a natural development of a deeper gene within it. But the fact that the natural instinct is to reject foreign elements helps convince us of the integrity of that which was. So basically, just to wrap up the point, I was trying to put down a confirmation, so to speak, of Torah Shebaal Peh's integrity. One is we do not find any variants of Torah Shebaal Peh anywhere in the world at any time, except for occasionally, a sinful debate. Yes, people started driving cars on Shabbos in America, but we will not call that the debate of Torah Shebaal Peh. People just rejected what was there. But in interpreting the halachas, zilch, in anything that's important, major, or whatever, we also have a natural tendency to resist ferociously anything that seems to be new, which helps us assure that that which we have is still part and parcel of the Torah that we have. And those are things that help convince us that Torah Sheval Peh is the same understanding of the mitzvahs that we have today was the understanding that Moshe got from Sinai. Okay? Okay, good.